Greetings, this is James Gillen. I'm your host today, and we've got another great show. We've got Paul Levy here, and he's got some amazing information coming out about, there's so many different areas. I'll just give you his bio first. He's a pioneer in the field of spiritual emergence, as well as an innovator in the field of dreaming, both night dreams as well as waking dreams. He's a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner for over 30 years. He has intimately studied with some of the greatest spiritual masters of Tibet and Burma. He's the author of The Madness of George Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis, as well as Watiko, the greatest epidemic sickness known to humanity. So without any further ado, I want to bring Paul on the show. Paul, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited to be here, James. So thank you for having me.
Great. Yeah, I've listened to several of your other interviews, especially one on Red Ice, and I thought it was amazing. And this, I'm really fascinated by Watiko, and you know, it really applies to my own life and what we are dealing with here, especially living on a vortex. You know, it's getting awful crazy here, and I know some people get it. It's kind of a paradox in a way. I was listening to the interview about Watiko and getting, you're almost damned if you do and damned if you don't, and you got to find something in the middle. But before we go any further, maybe you can explain just what Watiko is to our new listeners, to give them some kind of an understanding of what kind of energies we're dealing with.
Sure. Well, it's a Native American term, an indigenous term, really connoting the spirit of evil. And, you know, and it's this cannibalistic spirit that actually it exists all throughout the non-local field of consciousness, which is to say that it exists in the psyche, and it actually pervades the collective unconscious itself. So it's something we all can fall prey to at each and any moment. But what I'm pointing out in my new book, Dispelling Watiko, is that encoded in this spirit, it's actually revealing something to us. It could potentially help us to wake up. Mm-hmm. So sort of hidden or encoded in the spirit of this evil entity is a form of a blessing. And I should say it works through and with the projective tendencies of the mind in such a way. So it's a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, but it works through the projective tendencies of the mind in such a way so as to compel us to become its instrument, so that we unwittingly act it out while simultaneously it hides itself from being seen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one other way, because I endlessly describe it in my new book, or I describe it in as many ways as I can actually try to imagine. And it's a form of blindness. It's a psychic blindness that not only does it believe that it's sighted, but it arrogantly has a belief that it's more sighted than anyone else. So it's basically to fall under the spell of our own genius for creating reality in such a way that instead of our incredible gift serving us, it actually, in a sense, boomerangs and gets turned against us in a way that we're destroying ourselves. So that's a real simplistic way of describing what Watiko is.
Would you say another form of talking about would be, you know, we have this matrix that we've kind of fallen under the spell of this matrix that's going on right now. And it seems like the matrix is everything is external. You know, our outer appearances, you know, we're so focused on our outer appearances. We're so focused on material acquisition. We're so focused on getting acceptance and approval outside of ourselves. And we've been programmed through everything, you know, every media, you know, TV, radio, whatever, since children, you know, that, you know, you got to look a certain way, do a certain thing, buy the right thing and everything. And all of this will equate success and happiness. And to climb this ladder of success, the American dream, you know, which George Carlin says you have to be asleep to believe in it. But it just seems like it's almost, it fits into that matrix in a way. I mean, that's just part of it, but I'd love for you to expand on that a little bit.
Sure. Well, one way of understanding Watiko is it's the energy that, in a sense, inspires us to want to consume and it, you know, to fill this void in us, and consume both, you know, kind of refers to eating, but also buying. So we're endlessly trying to fill this void in us with stuff from the outside, but actually that void is not able to, it's an insatiable void. And so when we're taken over by Watiko, and any of us at any moment, you see, Watiko feeds on polarization. So if we see, oh, that person, they're taken over by Watiko and we're not, then that very point of view is mm-hmm. an expression that we ourselves are taken over by Watiko. And so, but the thing about Watiko is that it entrances us in such a way that whatever we perceive in our world, when we're under the spell of Watiko, we actually imagine that it exists in an objective fashion separate from us. So we then react to our projections, to our perceptions, as if they are separate from us. And we become, in a sense, conditioned by our reactions to our projections in an infinitely self-perpetuating feedback loop, which is a form of madness. Mm-hmm. And that's one way of describing Watiko. And at the bottom of that is that disassociating from our own intrinsic power and our own fullness. And, you know, like we were both saying, trying to fill that void by consuming and endlessly wanting more and more and more in a way that can never be, you know, filled.
Yeah. Now I'm curious about, this is the big $60 question, you know, that it's like I've always wondered about this because I went through various disciplines and many of the disciplines, you know, they talk about it's all Maya, it's all illusion. And you know, just ignore it. But you know, but at the same time, I'm up here in Washington State, and I'm watching the forests all go down, and I'm watching, you know, it be destroyed. And I actually talked to this one logger who was very involved in, you know, the Course of Miracles and everything else, and he said, "It's all an illusion, so it doesn't matter. You know, I can just take down the forest."
That's such a misunderstanding.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, and I just kind of go, well. You know, I said, in my belief system, I said, you know, if you create karma on the physical and you do a lot of destruction down here, that's going to go into the next level, and you're going to have to come back and deal with it. So it does affect your spiritual life, the non-physical world as well. So how do you disconnect the two?
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, one of the things about Watiko that is so, I don't even know what word to say, it's just an amazing phenomena in that it's a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul whose origin is the human psyche, and yet it somehow is able to dissolve the boundary between the inner and the outer in such a way that it can figure seemingly outer events so as to synchronistically express its inner condition inside of our soul. Mm-hmm. So, and that's very much like a dream where what's happening in the outer world is actually this reflection of an inner condition. So the idea is that what's happening in the outer world and what's happening in our inner psyche is really inseparable. And one other way of describing Watiko is that it's an expression of this inner disassociation between parts of ourselves and or between our inner landscape and the seeming outer reality, as if the two can be separated. And when we become entranced in that way, that's the fall under the spell of Watiko, such that we think we can destroy the forest and, oh, it's all an illusion, it's all a dream, it makes no difference. Where that's what, you know, when I was saying, my God, that's a total misunderstanding. Now, the thing about Watiko to understand, too, it's a collective psychosis. So it's something that any individual person can fall under its spell at any given moment. But it's also something that operates, because it operates through the collective unconscious, it will actually enlist numbers of us, whether it be in a family system or a group or a nation or a species, in such a way that we all, when people are under its thrall, we in a sense reinforce each other's unconsciousness, because Watiko works through our blind spot. It works through the part of us that isn't aware. And then when numbers of people fall prey in that same way to how Watiko is operating through the unconscious, they will feed off of and into each other's unconscious madness in a way that reinforces the disease. And that's what a psychic epidemic is. And that's what we're having right now. We're in the midst of a collective psychosis, and it's so pervasive that no one or hardly anyone is even talking about it because everything appears normal. But yet, when you look at what we're doing, we're actually destroying not only the forest, the old growth forest, but we're destroying the biosphere of the planet, which is the life support system of our planet. And and that's like this suicidal behavior. And yet people are just assuming, oh, it's business as usual. Everything's normal. We're not. I had said to one friend of mine, this was a few years ago, he saw me and he asked me what I was up to. And I said, oh, I'm in the middle of writing an article about the collective psychosis. And he said to me, he was serious. He says, well, what makes you think that we're in the middle of a collective psychosis? And I didn't even know what to say. And actually, I think what I did say to him is, well, what makes you think we're not? Give me one reason that makes you think we're not.
Yeah, there's something that, you know, I was trying to talk to some people about. And, you know, there's people involved in the war industry and the war machine. And they're also involved in certain other agencies, whatever. You know, and I asked him, I said, so you're in the business of controlling and enslaving and manipulating and killing, you know? And they go, well, no, I'm not. No, I'm here to defend America, you know? And I said, well, let's break this down. I said, you're going to some country that has nothing to do with us, a sovereign country, and you're spying on them and you're finding out how you can totally manipulate and control them. And in the end, we take over all their natural resources, and you know the things that you're building and sending over there and blowing off are killing innocent families and leveling buildings. But you know, and I said, so how do you put this together with walking in integrity and being a spiritual, you know, decent human being? And they go, well, you know, they always go, well, you know, it's a living, you know, I've got to take care of my family. You know, I need to buy the things to stay within the matrix, you know, to be a success within the matrix. And I said, you know, at the expense of your soul, right? You know, and right. That goes over like a lead brick.
Right. Well, that's the thing, you know, and that's an example that's really like very like this overt example. But then what about very well-intentioned people who are just office workers at you know, these multinational corporations, whether it's Monsanto or whatever, and they're just answering the phones. And so from their point of view, they're really not doing anything that's in any way bad, but yet they're just cogs in the machine.
Yeah.
And that's, you see, that points to something really interesting, that for us to actually be agents of positive change, we have to really shed light on our being complicit in what's playing out. And you see, the thing about Watiko, because it operates through our blind spots, and you know, to the extent we don't have consciousness about that, about how we unwittingly can, even in a small scale, in the small scale of our life with our partner or our family, we might be in a certain way, you know, unconsciously enacting some form of shadowy behavior. Well, that's energetically feeding into the non-local Watiko disease that pervades the field of consciousness. So it really is requiring us to really shed light on how we're actually complicit and having collusion, you know, with what's playing out. And that's why, you see, built into Watiko disease is in a way a counter incentive to self-reflect. Because, say, for example, people who are supporting, you know, Hitler or supporting Bush or Obama or whatever, fill in the blank, and then, you know, and they feel good about it, going, no, we're just following this well-intentioned leader who's, you know, who has our best interests at heart. And then say, if we actually see through the illusion and realize, oh my God, I've been giving away my power to somebody who, you know, doesn't deserve my trust. You know, here I've been thinking they've been protecting me, but they're the very ones I need protection from. That's a shattering insight that induces a form of trauma, that induces a form of PTSD. So that's what I'm pointing at, that encoded in the Watiko disease is its own counter incentive to see through it, because you have to be able to deal with the pain of, oh my God, I must have been out of my mind. I must have been besides myself to be actually supporting these people who are actually killing me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's kind of funny because I've been trying to explain that to somebody very close to me about, you know, when you are dishonest and you do deceive or use, or when you, you know, are do acts out of integrity or betray a trust or things like that, you know, there is a universal law. And although you can justify all that within the Matrix or within Watiko, I mean, that's all okay if you think that's okay. But then again, I believe that there, you know, there is such a thing as karma and universal law, and you can get caught up in this matrix that is totally unconscious. And then the other side of the Watiko or whatever, it totally justifies it.
Yeah. And the thing is, you see, so what I'm interested in my new book that just came out, you know, a couple months ago, is to actually break the spell of Watiko. That's why the subtitle of the book, it's called Breaking the Curse of Evil.
Yeah.
And it's very much like in a fairy tale that our people have fallen under a spell. And one of the ways of really breaking the spell is to see the field, the non-local field. This is a physics term, mm-hmm. you know, which has to do with it's not bound by the laws of third dimensional space and time, but in a way there's this deeper field, and this is total quantum physics. I mean, it was Einstein himself who said the real reality is the field. That's what's informing and underlying all of manifestation. Mm-hmm, and sure. What I'm saying is when you begin to see the field that interconnects everything and in which we're contained, that's to begin to see what I call the dreamlike nature of reality. Because when you're in a dream, just imagine, for example, let's invoke the imagination. Imagine we're in a dream, and when you recognize the nature of your situation in that dream, i.e. that you're in a dream, you begin to realize, oh my God, all the other people in the dream, these dream characters are not separate from me. They're actually embodied reflective aspects of me. We're all interconnected and interdependent. And mm-hmm. that's the realization you begin to see when you see the non-local field. You snap out of the illusion of the separate self that we exist only as an isolated entity, and you begin to recognize, oh my God, we're actually interconnected and interdependent. And interestingly, this has to do with one of the insights about ETs and unidentified flying objects that both Terence McKenna and Jung, they had something in common. They both felt that we were so disconnected and disassociated from the self, from the true self, that being that this is a dream, the only way the self can actually, in a sense, make our acquaintance and introduce ourselves is in the form of some alien other, that it's a projective mechanism. And so then when you see this as a dream, here's the self, which is our nature, and we're so, you know, like I was saying, disassociated, that it can only actually manifest in some, you know, complete like ET, UFO phenomena as a way of beginning to get our attention as far as who we are.
Mm-hmm. The way I look at that is there's a field, you know, a unified field of consciousness, and we're all focal points within that field. And some of us have a very small portion of the field that we're accepting as our identity. And other people have expanded, you know, into the one consciousness that encompasses all consciousness and all planes and dimensions, you know, throughout the multiverse. But there's within that field, depending on how much you expand into that field, is how much you're going to be privy to. And as you move up and be into your interdimensional or multidimensional self, you might say, you're going to experience all these other things going on, you know, energy ships with energy beings, light ships with light beings, other civilizations that are far beyond our imagination. But eventually what it all comes down to is it's all you.
Yeah. And one of the things that I talk about, so when you say it's all you, not the ego you, but it's more the you who you're discovering that you are.
Exactly. When you merge, you know, with the one consciousness that encompasses all consciousness, you know, on all planes and dimensions, you realize that that happened to me in my own near-death experience. I was really going through a ringer because these beings were all appearing to me on different levels and saying, I am you, you know, and there are different aspects of myself. And I was having a meltdown, my ego was. And then when I got into the God self level, you know, this being appeared to me and he just said, you know, it's all you.
And
and then I had to let go of my identity, you know, as my ego self. And you know, after that experience too, I realized it is all me. And there's aspects of myself that really need some cleanup, you know?
Yeah. And that brings me into one of the major things I talk about the book, you know, because the book is actually, like I said, the subtitle is Breaking the Curse of Evil. And I talk about the profound importance of shedding light on evil, because so many of like really well-intentioned, new age, spiritual, metaphysical people, they just don't even want to think about evil. They don't want to talk about it. Oh, I don't want to put my attention there because if I put my attention there, I'm feeding it. But what they don't realize is that it's very different when you see evil and you choose to look away. That's as a sovereign being, we can actually decide where we want to place our attention compared to when we're just avoiding evil out of fear. Oh, I don't want to place my attention there because, you know, and if we're coming out of the avoidance, we're unwittingly feeding the very evil that we're not wanting to attend to. And so, yeah, it's not a good idea to become too fascinated with evil. We don't want to avoid it, but we can see it. We can see how it operates through the psyche and synchronistically through the outside world as a reflection of the evil in us. And then, like I was saying, we can choose how we want to invest our attention. And I would suggest, yeah, we can invest our attention in, oh, I want to create a world I want to live in. That's a way of investing our attention, but we can only do that when we're not avoiding the darkness, mm-hmm. when we're not actually reacting out of fear, okay? So it's really sad for me when I see a lot of these New Age spiritual people who are unwittingly, with the best of intentions, they're feeding the very evil that they're not wanting to look at.
Yeah, I agree. There's I've always brought that up, and it's really pissed off a lot of New Age people that I said, you know, a lot of the New Age program was actually created by the controllers, you know, the Illuminati, to get you to not look at what they're doing. And if you do see the evil or the negative, then they lay a guilt trip on you that it's you and you created it. So I said, what better way to just totally operate fully unchecked than to get you to not look at it and not do anything?
Yeah. And that's why when I was saying before, the thing, one way of understanding what Tico is that it's a form of blindness because it's a form of not looking, you know, of not seeing, of being a not see. And so the thing is, one of the deeper psychological, because there are all these different aspects of what Tico. So you see, I've really tried to unfold, you know, just the deeper, like the psychological dynamic, the spiritual dynamic, the mythological dynamic, because it's a multidimensional phenomenon, this Watiko. The psychological dynamic is having to do with when we project the shadow. And so think about the shadow as like, you know, the inferior part of ourselves that we don't like or we despise or we don't own. And we can have a positive shadow too, the part of us that's really enlightened and we're split off and we just project onto our guru. But I'm more talking about, at least in this discussion, the real, like the dark negative part of our shadow. Mm-hmm. So to the extent we don't see that, you know, our own evil, for example, to the extent we don't see that, we then split off from it. In ourselves, this is so far just an inner process that I'm describing, but then we actually project, like, you know, think about in a dream. If I split off from a part of myself in a dream, what's going to happen? I project it out and it gets dreamed up into the dream in seemingly outside, separate, objective seeming form. So then into the dream will walk somebody or a group of people who will embody and carry that split off projected shadow energy in myself. And now I have all the evidence I need that the evil in the shadow is out there because somebody's embodying it, which then entrenches me even further in the viewpoint of the evils outside of myself. So I even more projected outside of myself. And the more I do that, the more it appears that way. So now I've actually participated and created in a self-generated, self-perpetuating, this negative feedback loop of where I've created all the proof I need that the evil is outside of myself, which I then react to by trying to destroy, which is a reflection of the very inner process that started this whole process. And by doing that, I've literally become possessed by the very evil that I'm actually trying to destroy out there. And what I've just described, that's Watiko. That's the psychological dynamic that underlies and informs Watiko.
Yeah, I've got two questions for you. One is that it does seem that, let's say if we're dishonest or disloyal or very self-centered, just only caring about ourselves and things of that nature, and running that program, you know, in the matrix, everything is external, you know, what's in it for me? I need to make myself happy, you know, period. You're running this program, let's say, and then down the road, the next person you bring into your life will do all the same things that you just did to others, or will run the same program that you just ran. That's one extreme. But I always see that in that program. Let's say in one of my experiences, I saw that I had something in a past life, very ancient, I haven't seen before. And in a way, this person brought that to my attention so I could heal it. So the negative actually did bring something to my attention so I could go back and heal that. So in a way, it was a gift. But at the same time, I was told very clearly that does not relieve the other person of the being accountable for their choices and their actions and their drama in that situation.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And no, I couldn't have said it better. So that's, it makes me think of that, like I was saying before, that encoded in Watiko is not only its own antidote, but is a form of blessing that it can literally help us to wake up if we actually recognize what it's showing us. And what it's basically showing us is the dreamlike nature, that we're actually dreaming. You see, you can't really see Watiko if you don't recognize that we're having, in a sense, it is as if we're having a mass shared dream. Mm-hmm. And that all of us are dreaming up the Watiko epidemic, we're dreaming up the destruction of the biosphere. All of this is actually like reflecting and revealing and unveiling a process that's happening deep inside of us. And when we actually, recognize that, that's when we begin to awaken. So one way of understanding this in alchemy and Gnosticism and Kabbalah, all the wisdom traditions, they all talk about the same thing, that encoded in the darkness are the sparks of light. And it's our role to actually discover the light that's hidden in the evil, mm-hmm. and to actually help that light to return to its source, and that in a sense puts evil in its place, puts us in our place, in our proper place in the cosmos. It's showing us that, no, we have a particular crucial role in the incarnation, in the divine incarnation. And that's, in a sense, what Watiko is showing us.
Mm-hmm. Now, the best way to stay out of Watiko, I mean, we've been given the basics that, you basically, when you operate, out of, the universal laws, you might say universal peace, brother, sisterly love, strong reverence for life, freedom and prosperity for everybody, or unity consciousness. Whenever we're holding to those principles, we can kind of avoid a lot of the pitfalls. But it seems like as soon as we step into I don't want to say our ego self, let's say our wounded ego self, And we're running those patterns that the wounded ego that, has a sense of entitlement or thinks it's justified in stepping outside of universal law or whatever, then it seems like we fall under the spell of Watiko.
Yeah. Well, in my first book, the one on the madness of George W. Bush, I was talking about Watiko, but I wasn't calling it by that name. Yet I made up my own name, malignant egophrenia,
yeah,
or me disease, and it's an actual misidentification of who we imagine we are. And it's pointing, and I pointed out that the ego isn't a bad thing at all. It's actually this, in a sense, this transport system that was developed by the higher self to like bring us to our, you know, to like the remembrance of who we are. But when we actually overly identify with it, then it becomes toxic. And some people really do develop like an over-identification with the evil, with the ego, in that it becomes like this, you know, like malignant egophrenia. And so that's really, really true. And you see, in the ultimate sense, because in my new book, I go into what is the ultimate root source, fundamental foundation of evil. And I point out that from every wisdom tradition, it's actually our grasping onto an imaginary self that doesn't exist, onto that me that doesn't even, as an entity, as a reference point, that doesn't even exist in the way we imagine it does. And us having that clinging or that grasping then will elaborate itself over the multi-dimensions of our being in such a way that it actually manifests as what we call evil, as it plays out in the greater body politic. But the point is that we ourselves are the generator of that, and it's not something that happened way in the past. It's something that we're actually creatively participating in this very moment of either creating that grasping, which leads to that evil, or not, and seeing through that, and that's where we actually can become, you know, an agent of change who can really make a genuine, you know, who can really help in this world.
Yeah, it seems like now in the Native American tradition, they usually don't even have a word for I or me. It's always we, you know, that they don't even understand that program. And it seems like when we do get into the me, you know, what's in it for me, I need this, and me, and we get out of unity consciousness and don't see the big picture on how our actions and choices affect others, the world, the planet, the environment, you know, and when we get away from looking at how's this going to affect the next generations, we actually get a total disconnect from our soul and spirit, which has a whole nother program, you know, or let's say a whole nother contract, whatever you want to call it, that we came in to do, and that gets hijacked by the conditionings of social consciousness, or the me, or the matrix, or the Watiko, you know, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But I see that over and over again, where a lot of these programs are all to pull you to the external, to pull you into everything being external, and pull you away from the internal side of things, where a lot of these things, if you were focused on the internal, you would be in touch with your soul and spirit. You would know your unique purpose for being here, and you'd be on track, and you wouldn't be under the influence of all these other influences.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's, so that opens up a lot of things in my mind, because you see, I just want to go back to something. The thing about Watiko, it's in a way this counterfeiting spirit. It's like this imitator, where it'll shapeshift and actually put us on like a suit of clothes, like putting us on like a suit of clothes, but also putting us on like it fools us, in that it shapeshifts and assumes our form. And then if we're not awake to what it's doing, we then identify with its form, with its thoughts, with its beliefs, and just, you know, in an innocent way, assume that they're our thoughts and that they're our beliefs and this is who we are. And then unwittingly, we become the instrument for Watiko to act itself out. And the way to understand this, Watiko is a mind virus. It's a parasite of the mind, or you could think of it like being like a tapeworm. Mm-hmm. And think about what a tapeworm is. It gets into your system, and then it will secrete chemicals so that you begin to crave food that feeds the tapeworm. So it grows bigger, and it's killing you, the host. And all the while you're thinking you're feeding yourself, but you're actually feeding the tapeworm.
Yeah.
Okay. And that brings me to the next point, that the way, you see, because as soon as we start to fight against Watiko, we've already lost, because it feeds on polarization. Mm-hmm. And that's its signature. But the way to vanquish Watiko is to get in touch. You see, the thing about Watiko, it will actually take us over through our blind spot in such a way that we literally, people who become full-blown Watikos become possessed by it.
Yeah.
And, But the way, and they don't even, the part of it by definition is that they don't even know they're possessed by it. And, but the way to vanquish Watiko is to get in touch with the part of us that's not possessable, which
exactly.
is the self, which is the self. That's the true nature. And that's the part of us that's Watiko's worst nightmare is for us to remember that, is for us to remember that we're always in possession of our true nature. So the thing about Watiko, it's not like, it doesn't even exist, ultimately speaking. It's not any objective phenomena that we have to be scared about that it's going to infect us. But what it'll do, it will actually trick us. So it can't take our nature from us, but it can trick us to seemingly give it our power. And
mm-hmm.
then we've lost, okay?
I agree. You know, now I'm going to run something by you. This is really interesting in my own experiences that through the years, they have an old saying, you know, in the yoga traditions and things, that the closer you get to nirvana, the more the demons will rear their ugly heads. And I guess we could call this, you know, Watiko. But it seems to me that this has many aspects to it. And I'm wondering if these forms exist in and of themselves, because I've been dealing with, you know, a lot of discarnate beings, fourth dimensional beings that are jumping into people and possessing people. If you get off track and you have no self-worth and you do a lot of drugs, or you just get too wrapped up in your physical expression or whatever, devoid of spirit, you know, your field, your collective field gets down, and these other entities will jump in. And I've seen different types of them. I've seen astral beings. I've seen tall grays totally manipulate people. I've seen these serpent type beings manipulate people. And then people totally separate from me, I'll tune into them and I'll see what's going on. And then they'll send me a photograph with this big black snake ball or something in their aura, in their field. You know, it's happened over and over again. Well, they'll say, why is this big black spot over my head right now? And it's quite interesting when you look at this, at this, what's unfolding here. And it seems like it's the many divisions of Watiko. And I guess as God beings, we created this whole scenario for some reason. But at the same time, it's at this time in our lives on the planet, with all the incoming energies, these energies are totally revealing themselves and becoming exposed and just running amok, and especially the light workers are just attacking them like crazy.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's a very interesting question. Like, do these demons, you know, interesting, the indigenous term demon, psychologically, Jung calls them autonomous complexes. They're part of the wholeness of the psyche that are split off and develop a seeming quasi-life or independent will of their own. And so one way to understand this is that, just like a dream is like this multidimensional phenomena, just like this universe. And so from the ultimate point of view, the absolute ultimate point of view, there's no demons, there's no negative ETs, negative entities. It's all just your own energy. There's no other. And yet, then there's from the reality that's the relative reality. Then, and that from that point of view, which is seemingly distinct from the ultimate point of view, there are demons and negative entities, you know, that don't have our best intentions in mind. But the thing to understand is that the absolute and the relative points of view interpenetrate each other, and you can't just, you know, I know a lot of spiritual people who just identify with the absolute point of view, going, oh, everything's one, everything's me, there's nothing that exists separate from me. And then they're just, you know, they have like this marginalization of the relative, and that's a big mistake. You have to deal with the relative. Like I was saying, the relative interpenetrates and is inseparable from the absolute. So one example that I can give to more understand this, one of my teachers, this great enlightened Tibetan, this Lama, had come to Portland to visit me a number of years ago, and was giving this empowerment. And an empowerment is like this ceremony where he transmits his, you know, blessings. And the particular empowerment was to dispel black magic.
Uh-huh.
And we had so many people come, literally like 300, 400, 500 people. We had to turn people away because so many people wanted to have their black magic dispelled. And as he was giving the empowerment, he was giving explanations. And he says, this empowerment will not dispel black magic. this empowerment will dispel your belief in black magic, because it's your belief in black magic that is itself the black magic. That black magic intrinsically doesn't have any intrinsic independent existence. It doesn't have any objective existence whatsoever other than whatever we invest in it as actually existing. And that, I think, is really, really an important point, that when we're really awake in the dream and we're in touch with that self, like I was describing before, the part of us that's not possessable by anything outside of ourselves, then there's nothing that can harm us. Then we're really genuinely protected. Then there's no such thing. Then the negative ET or the demon or whatever, and this is even in the Buddha, when the Buddha became enlightened, the forces of like Mara, the evil one, they were in despair. Mara was, once Buddha became enlightened, because he actually said, oh my God, the exalted one sees me, there's nothing I can do. Because when you actually see Watiko or Mara or the evil forces and you see how they operate, they have no power over you in the same way. This is expressed in the myth of like vampire myths, where once the sun rises, the vampire has no power. Because once you add consciousness to the demon and you find its right name, and I talk about all this in the book, because finding the name in like fairy tales and mythology, when you find not just any name, but the right name, the proper name of the demon, you take away its power, because then it has no autonomy and it has no its power is taken away.
Yeah. And I know it's important to actually, for me, in my experience, you know, I was very well trained in dispelling these type of energies. And the way I do it really is I focus on the person as being a God being, you know, that within everybody is a beautiful, powerful, manifesting God or goddess, you know, that's just totally blissed out. And so everything else is just, you know, basically the dream or the illusion or whatever. The problem I get snagged by is when I get tied into other people's, you know, programs, and I just want to hang out in bliss and just be kind and loving and joyous and live in peace and harmony with the land and each other. But, you know, it's hard to do when we are living in a society, even in a spiritual society. There's all these other things coming in, and it does seem to be the more you're holding that higher frequency, that energy, it's like a moth coming to a flame. These other entities are coming in, and I think they're coming in, most of them are coming in for their own transformation and healing. You know, but it does seem, it's like a paradox, like you're saying, you know, you have the absolute, which really you want to make your mind single on and focus on. But at the same time, in this world that we're in, you know, we have family, we have friends, we have lovers, and they may not be focused on the same program that we're on.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why for example, I do Tibetan Buddhist practice, and they talk about the three jewels that you go for the refuge in: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, and the community. Mm-hmm. And that's the Sangha. And the Buddha actually, you know, gave a teaching talking about how incredibly important it is who you hang out with. He basically has a teaching where, you know, a translation might be, you know, to not hang out with fools.
Yeah.
And you hang out with people who are awakening. And my most favorite translation of the word bodhisattva is a being in the process of awakening, and who among us is not that. Mm-hmm. When you hang out with people who are in the process of awakening, it's a contagious field. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's what I call, you can actually dream yourselves awake. And that's real, because we really affect and influence each other in how we actually reflect and project onto each other, because we think of projections as these, you know, they're not like a palpable energy, they're invisible, but they actually are. They carry a palpable energetic weight. They really affect us. When somebody is seeing us in a negative way based on their own being asleep, it actually touches the part of us that has a resonance with that negative energy, and then it invokes that part of us that's the negative energy. And then if we're not careful, next thing we know, we're embodying that. And then to the extent that we're embodying that, we're seeing them in a negative way, which is then invoking their negative part even further. And it becomes this negative spiral feedback loop just towards like the shadow and the unconscious in a negative, you know, realm. But the opposite is also true. if I see you, like what you were just saying, if I see you in your God self or however you call it, your Buddha nature, and I can only see you in that way if I'm in touch with my own Buddha nature, then I'm actually, like, in a way, giving you an invitation or creating a bridge for you to step into. So, you know, instead of being hooked by, say, if you're manifesting in a really kind of wounded way, I call that, that's the Halloween costume. Instead of being hooked by that, and if I just see you for who you really are and your Buddha nature and I relate to that who you are, I'm actually extending you an invitation and creating a bridge for you to more step into that. And the more you step into that, the more you're able to see the Buddha nature in me. So then it's actually helping me. You see, so that's in a way the whole, like, the new paradigm point of view, where if I help you, it's actually I get as much healing as you do because we're not separate. You know, and the energetic, the expression of that realization is compassion. That's why when people ask me, oh, how can I wake up in the dream and what is the practice or the technique that I can do? What I always say is, well, you know, in Buddhism, they talk about awakening in the dream as having two factors, as what's called emptiness and compassion. Mm-hmm. And emptiness is, think about emptiness as being like when you're in a night dream and you recognize, instead of being entranced by the forms of the dream, which is just your own mind as being real and solid and separate and objectively existing and separate from you, you actually see the nature of your situation. That is, oh my God, this world I'm in is empty. It has no intrinsic, independent existence separate from my own mind. That's emptiness. And the energetic expression of that realization is compassion. So if you people want to wake up, if they can cultivate that heart of compassion, that's actually in the service of their lucidity and of their awakening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I noticed that also, too, sometimes there is a time, too, for boundaries where, let's say if somebody is operating from their wounded ego or from a lower self and you know, doing everything imaginable outside of universal law and almost becoming an infection, you know, there is a point where you have to set some boundaries and say, hey, look, you know, this is where I'm going. You know, I want to be in a loving, supportive, you know, God-connected, service-oriented relationship, you know, where you know, there is a lot of honesty and loyalty and compassion, all these things, you know, the higher levels. And I can't participate in this other program. So sometimes you do have to set boundaries and just say, you know, have fun on your journey. You know, I'll see you when you're done with it. And, you know, it sounds bad, but enjoy the train wreck, you know, because when you do operate outside of universal law, you know, running the me program and me and mine and my and everything else, it is going to be a train wreck. And especially if you have been, you know, dishonest or out of integrity or whatever in that program and use people, you know, it's definitely going to have, you know, the same effect to you. It's just the way universal law or karma works.
Yeah, and that's why, like, the thing about when I talk about the Wetiko virus, I talk about that it ultimately, you know, it destroys everything and anything within its sphere of influence, including itself. Mm-hmm. So it's this totally self and other destroying, you know, energy. And the thing about the boundaries, you know, people think about compassion as being smiley faced and let's pat each other on the back, but that can be called, some traditions call that, that's like idiot compassion.
Yeah.
Your compassion can be really fierce and really set a boundary and say no. And, you know, and that I think is important to understand. Now, one thing I just want to, because as we're getting maybe closer to ending, I really want to invoke something that is really being offered to us by Wetiko. Because like I was saying before, that encoded in this pathology is some form of blessing. And one way to understand this, just you know, let's invoke the imagination, the creative, divine imagination, and let's invoke the metaphor of a dream, that imagine you're in a night dream, and imagine you recognize the nature of your situation, which is to say that you're dreaming. And that's one thing. But then there are still all these other dream characters who are aspects of yourself in that dream. And imagine, and this, you know, really imagine this, that then a second person in that dream, this is another dream character, another aspect of yourself, that they recognize the nature of their situation, i.e. that they're in a dream and that they're dreaming. And then imagine not just two, but 10 or 100 of those dream characters in that dream that you're the dreamer of. It's what I call the deeper dreaming self. And imagine, you know, 100 or 1,000 or however many people coming together and recognizing that this world that they're in, the dream, is just a materialization of their own dreaming, of their own consciousness. Mm-hmm. And they contemplate what they're like discovering together, they can actually have the realization of, oh my God, we can put, it's what I call our sacred power of dreaming, the part of us that's dreaming the dream into materialization. We could put our sacred power of dreaming together in a way so that we can change the dream. And that's evolution. And that's not just like a metaphor for that night dream. That's what's available to us in the waking dream. Mm-hmm. And that's completely amazing. And I wanted to make sure to just offer that thought form to people who are really hearing this, because that's really inspiring, because it's very easy to get absorbed in despair with all the evil that's playing out in our world. But when we hold that viewpoint of pessimism and despair, that's to fall under the prey of Watiko, because when we view things in that way, we're going to, in a self-fulfilling prophecy, then invoke a world that's worthy of despair, which then confirms our viewpoint in a self-perpetuating feedback loop. And that's once again to Watiko has, you know, subsumed our the creative like genius that we all have in us for creating reality against us in such a way that we're destroying ourselves. So it's, I think it's really important to connect with that the genius inside of us in a way where we can actually dream ourselves awake, and in a way conspire to co-inspire to activate the collective genius in all of us, such that the sum is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And so basically what I'm pointing at is that there's something really being shown to us that's available to us that can really help us to wake up.
I think it's so mandatory right now that we do wake up, because, you know, I like what Krishnamurti said. It's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And right. And when we look at our society, you know, with all of the wars and the diseases, most of them manufactured, the chemtrails, the condition of our government, our religious institutions that are doing the separation me game, and just the whole, you look at the whole thing, it can be very disheartening, or you might just want to give up. But at the same time, there's another world that's coming in, which is, I call it the fifth dimensional overlay that's infiltrating this world, and it's bringing all of this up to the surface and giving us a really good look at our shadow side and what we're doing and what we're doing that is functional and what's dysfunctional. And it's just part of an evolutionary process. The Earth herself, I think the whole solar system is going through it. And I see that this Watiko is being exposed on a very grand level, all the different aspects of it, for us all to take a big look at it and see, you know, how our choices and actions are feeding it, and how we're participating in it, and how we can actually choose a completely different path if we desire.
Yeah, no, totally. And what you've said this a few times, and it's right on, that, you know, this darkness, this shadow, is really manifesting in our world in such a way, you know, that it can be fully seen by anybody who has open eyes. It's as if this shadow, instead of, you know, hiding in the corners or underground, is becoming fully visible, you know, for everybody to look at. And that's an expression that light is nearby. Mm-hmm. The fact that when there's such a deep, dark shadow, like the thing about a shadow is simultaneously both an absence of light while also an expression of its presence. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so that's where, when we see the darkness and we realize it's so easy to get entranced into, you know, like a pessimistic point of view, feel, you know, with despair. But if we actually have the recognition, oh wow, this is actually an expression that light is actually emerging into the dream in the same way individually, because you had said this, like I remember a number of years ago I was having a hard time, and I would go to these lamas, and they would say, and I would be describing about these negative energies that were coming into my field, and they said, Paul, the fact that there are these demons that are coming so wanting to mess with you, it's an expression that you have so much light That's why they're coming. And in the same way, on the individual dimension, as we get closer to the light, you know, it's an archetypal process that these demons, these negative forces, get conjured up and make their worst stink. Almost like, you know, they're like these guardians of a threshold, and they're testing us. And it's so easy, right at the point that we're going to step into the light, to just give up or to identify with the demons or think our situation is hopeless. But it's really, really, you know, so important to recognize, no, that's an expression that I'm just getting close, and I need to stabilize my courage and my commitment, you know, my bodhisattvic commitment, and open my heart and keep my lucidity and just keep my eye on the goal. And, you know, one other image is like when, you know, a woman is giving birth, it's like there's the labor pains, which are so painful, but if you can keep your eye on the prize, so to speak, some of my teachers have said this, that can really help you to get through. And I think that's, in a sense, we're all in, collectively, we're all in this shamanic death rebirth process. It's like the greater body politic is having a collective, like, breakdown. Mm-hmm. Such so that something can break through and a deeper order can emerge that's more in alignment with who we're discovering that we are.
Yeah, I feel the same way. When I see all the turmoil going on, and, you know, I see the Pope stepping down, the Queen stepping down, and, you know, all of these things happening, the politicians finally getting exposed, and all the people waking up and seeing, you know, that they say one thing and do the opposite, and there's just a mass awakening, and everybody goes, this is just as black as you can get right now. And I go, no, this is good. It's all coming to the surface. You know, I even root for the earth changes. I go, all right. You know, I root for Mother Earth. Yeah, let's go. You know, let's clean up whatever needs to be cleaned up. You know, if you need to take me out with you on the cleanup process, great. You know, but it's right. Kind of like a different opinion. I'm almost excited that, you know, all of this stuff is coming forward. And I, you know, too, I love to see people when they're processing cry, because the tear's worth 1,000 years of karma. You know, you're letting go of it. You're releasing it. And so at the other end of the release is who you really are. It's this loving, joyous, blissful goddess being or God being. And so this is all a process that we're going through. It's just tearing away the garbage that we falsely identified with right now, that we thought was who we are and what would bring us joy and happiness and where our security lies. And we have to go through that process until we finally figure it out that we have to go within. The external isn't going to cut it. And when enough of us go within and find that internal being within us, that God being within us, everything else is just going to fall away. And I think that's when we are going to finally have this 1,000 years of peace and this major quantum leap, or what do you call it, the 100th monkey. Everybody has a name for it, critical mass.
Sure. And the thing I wanted is two things just, you know, before we close. And one is, you're totally right about the importance of going within. But then when you discover that the boundary between the inner and the outer collapses, because I see a lot of well-intentioned spiritual people, and they're just like, oh, I'm just going to meditate and do my prayers and not engage with the world. And that's a huge mistake. That's that they're just absorbed in like this self-absorption, where, because one of the mediums of working on your inner state is by fully participating in the outer world, you know?
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing, it's a beautiful image that I would want to like close with, and that is, for me, it's like, okay, think about when you have a glass of water and you're taking these sugar granules and you're dissolving them one by one in the water, mm-hmm. and they just dissolve and dissolve, and then the water reaches the saturation point, and you add one more grain of sugar and a crystal will spontaneously manifest. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful metaphor for any one of us, maybe even in this moment, self-reflecting, having the recognition of the dreamlike nature, seeing our shadow, seeing how Watiko works, seeing our, you know, our own evil or our collusion or our complicity with it. Any one of us doing that, maybe even in this moment, might be that grain of sugar that will crystallize a change in the entire collective unconscious. Like you were saying, that's the 100th monkey phenomena. And I think that's a really inspiring way of framing who we are, the role we play, and just our, you know, our interconnectedness. And at least I think a lot of people, when they contemplate that, it can really create a sense of inspiration to continue on and to take the next step, and that we really, any of us, I mean, we're such powerful beings that we really, really can make a difference.
Yeah, it's all about balance. I see we're so out of balance right now, unfortunately, operating out of the external, that to bring balance back. The same thing with the masculine patriarchal program here. We've gotten so out of balance there. We need a huge influx of the divine feminine, to come in and bring balance back. But it does. It all comes back to balance, and I see God in the physical as just an external expression of God, and we can create heaven on earth, but we can't ignore earth, as part of that process. But anyway, we're at the end of the hour. What is the best way people can get in touch with you and maybe get a copy of your books and find out more about the work that you're doing?
Sure. Well, I have this website, and it's www.awaken, AWAKEN, inthedream.com, awakeninthedream.com, and you can get my new book, Dispelling Watiko, there, autographed copies, and I pay for shipping. And there's also a ton of articles, all for free, all about this stuff. There's a bunch of audio interviews all for free. There's video of the book release I just did at PALS in downtown Portland. And yeah, I just want to get this work out.
Great.
And so that's where, and then, on the website, there's a place if you want to contact me, you can just send me an email. And so yeah, that's what you would need to know.
Great. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and we'll have all that information up on the website and for the show. And again, thank you so much for sharing, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, James, thank you so much, so much. It's really been my pleasure, and same to you. Keep up the great work on your end.